envelope. Write a letter to someone you love. Make it as long as you want or as short as you want. I don't care. But fill it with everything you wished you could say, but never had the chance. Do you understand? What if I don't love anybody? She purses her lips and shakes her head slowly. You unwinds are all the same. You think that because no one loves you, then you can't love anyone. All right, then. If there's no one you love, then pick someone who needs to hear what you have to say. Say everything that's in your heart. Don't hold back. And when you're done, put it in the envelope and seal it. I'm not going to read it, so don't worry about that. What's the point? Are you going to mail it? Just do it and stop asking questions. Then she takes a little ceramic dinner bell and places it on the roll-top desk next to the pen and paper. Take all the time you need, and when you're done, ring the bell. Then she leaves him alone. It's an odd request, and Connor actually finds himself a bit frightened by it. There are places inside he simply doesn't want to go. He thinks he might write to Ariana. That would be easiest. He had cared about her. She was closer to him than any other girl had ever been. Every girl except Risa. But then, Risa doesn't really count. What he and Risa have isn't a relationship. It's just two people clinging to the same ledge, hoping not to fall. After about three lines of his letter, Connor crumples the page. Writing to Ariana feels pointless. No matter how much he's resisted, he knows who he needs to address this letter to. He presses his pen to a fresh page and writes, "Dear Mom and Dad." It's 5 minutes before he can come up with another line, but once he does, the words start flowing. And in strange directions, too. At first it's angry, as he knew it would be. How could you? Why did you? What kind of people could do this to their kid? Yet by the third page it mellows. It becomes about all the good things that happened in their lives together. At first he does it to hurt them, and to remind them exactly what they've thrown away when they signed the order to unwind him. But then it becomes all about remembering, or more to the point, getting them to remember, so that when he's gone, if he's gone, there will be a record of all the things he felt were worth keeping alive. When he started, he knew how the letter would end. "I hate you for what you've done, and I'll never forgive you." But when he finally reaches the 10th page, he finds himself writing, "I love you, your one-time son, Connor." Even before he signs his name, he feels the tears welling up inside. They don't seem to come from his eyes, but from deep in his gut. It's a heaving so powerful it hurts his stomach and his lungs. His eyes flood, and the pain inside is so great, he's certain it will kill him right here, right now. But he doesn't die, and in time the storm inside him passes, leaving him weak in every joint and muscle of his body. He feels like he needs Sonia's cane just to walk again. His tears have soaked into the pages, warping little craters in the paper but not smudging the ink. He folds the pages and slips them into the envelope, then seals and addresses it. He takes a few more minutes to make sure the storm won't come back, then he rings the little bell. Sonia steps in moments later. She must have been waiting all this time just on the other side of that curtain. Connor knows she must have heard him bawling, but she doesn't say a thing. She looks at his letter, hefts it in her hand to feel its weight, and raises her eyebrows, impressed. "Had a lot to say, did you?" Connor only shrugs. She puts the envelope face down on the table again. "Now I want you to put a date on the back. Write down the date of your 18th birthday." Connor doesn't question her anymore. He does as she asks. When he's done, she takes the envelope from him. "I'm going to hold this letter for you," she tells him. "If you survive to 18, you must promise that you'll come back here to get it. Will you make me that promise?" Connor nods. "I promise." She shakes the letter at him to help make her point. "I will keep this until a year after your 18th birthday. If you don't come back, I'll assume you didn't make it, that you were unwound. In that case, I'll send the letter myself." Then she hands the letter back to him, stands, and goes over to the old trunk that had covered the trap door. She opens the latch and, although it must be heavy, heaves open the lid to reveal envelopes, hundreds of them, filling the trunk almost up to the top. "Leave it here," she says. "It will be safe. If I die before you come back, Hannah has promised to take care of the trunk." Connor thinks of all the kids Sonia must have helped to have this many letters in her trunk, and he feels another wave of emotion taking hold of his gut. It doesn't quite bring him to tears, but it makes him feel all soft inside. Soft enough to say, "You've done something wonderful here." Sonia waves her hand, swatting the thought away. "You think this makes me a saint? Let me tell you, I've had a considerably long life, and I've done some pretty awful things, too." "Well, I don't care. No matter how many times you smack me with that cane, I think you're decent." "Maybe, maybe not. One thing you learn when you've lived as long as I have, people aren't all good, and people aren't all bad. We move in and out of darkness and light all of our lives. Right now, I'm pleased to be in the light." On his way downstairs, she makes sure to smack him on the butt with her cane, hard enough to sting, but it only makes him laugh. He doesn't tell Risa what's in store for her. Somehow telling her would be stealing something from her. Let this be between her, Sonia, the pen, and the page, as it had been for him. She leaves the baby with him as she goes up to face the old woman. It's asleep, and right now, in this place, and at this moment, there's something so comforting about holding it in his arms, he's thankful he saved it. And he thinks that if his soul had a form, this is what it would be, a baby sleeping in his arms. 20. Risa. The next time Sonia opens the trap door, Risa knows things are changing again. The time has come to leave the safety of Sonia's basement. Risa's the first in line when Sonia calls them to come up. Roland would have been, but Connor threw an arm out like a turnstile to let Risa get to the stairs first. With a sleeping baby crooked in her right arm and her left hand on the rusty steel banister, Risa climbs the jagged stone steps. Risa assumes she'll be climbing into daylight, but it's night. The lights are out in the shop, just a few nightlights are on, carefully positioned so the kids can avoid the minefield of random antiques around them. Sonia leads them to a back door that opens into an alley. There's a truck waiting for them there. It's a small delivery truck. On its side is a picture of an ice cream cone. Sonia hadn't lied. It is the ice cream man. The driver stands beside the open back door of the truck. He's a scruffy guy who looks like he'd more likely be delivering illegal drugs than kids. Roland, Hayden, and Mai head for the truck, but Sonia stops Risa and Connor. "Not yet, you two." Then Risa notices a figure standing in the shadows. Risa's neck hairs begin to bristle defensively, but when the figure steps forward, she realizes who it is. It's Hannah, the teacher who saved them at the high school.
"Honey, the baby can't go where you're going," Hannah says.
Reflexively, Risa holds the baby closer to her. She doesn't even know why. All she's wanted to do since getting stuck with the thing is to get rid of it.
"It's all right," says Hannah. "I've talked it over with my husband. We'll just say we were storked. It'll be fine."
Risa looks in Hannah's eyes. She can't see all that well in the dim light, but she knows the woman means what she says. Connor, however, steps between them. "Do you want this baby?"
"She's willing to take it," says Risa. "That's enough."
"But does she want it? Did you want it?" That seems to give Connor pause for thought. Risa knows he didn't want it, but he had been willing to take it when the alternative was a miserable life with a miserable family. Just as Hannah is willing to save it from an uncertain future right now. Finally, Connor says,
"It's not an it. It's a she."
Then he heads off toward the truck.
"We'll give her a good home," Hannah says.
She takes a step closer, and Risa transfers the baby to her. The moment the baby is out of her arms, Risa feels a tremendous sense of relief, but also an indefinable sense of emptiness. It's a feeling not quite intense enough to leave her in tears, but strong enough to leave her with a phantom sort of aching, the type of thing an amputee must feel after losing a limb. That is, before a new one is grafted on.
"You take care now," says Sonia, giving Risa an awkward hug. "It's a long journey, but I know you can make it."
"Journey to where?"
Sonia doesn't answer.
"Hey," says the driver, "I don't got all night."
Risa says goodbye to Sonia, nods to Hannah, and turns to join Connor, who's waiting for her at the back of the truck. As Risa leaves, the baby starts to cry, but she doesn't look back. She's surprised to find about a dozen other kids in the truck, all distrustful and scared. Roland's still the biggest, and he solidifies his position by making another kid move, even though there's plenty of other places to sit. The delivery truck is a hard, cold metal box. It once had a refrigeration unit to keep the ice cream cold, but that's gone along with the ice cream. Still, it's freezing in there, and it smells of spoiled dairy. The driver closes and locks the back doors, sealing out the sound of the baby, who Risa can still hear crying. Even after the door is closed, she thinks she can still hear it, although it's probably just her imagination. The ice cream truck bounces along the uneven streets. The way the truck sways, their backs are constantly smacked against the wall behind them. Risa closes her eyes. It makes her furious that she actually misses the baby. It was thrust upon her at the worst possible moment in her life. Why should she have any regret about being rid of it? She thinks about the days before the Heartland War, when unwanted babies could just be unwanted pregnancies, quickly made to go away. Did the women who made that other choice feel the way she felt now? Relieved and freed from an unwelcome and often unfair responsibility, yet vaguely regretful? In her days at the state home, when she was assigned to take care of the infants, she would often ponder such things. The infant wing had been massive and overflowing with identical cribs, each containing a baby that nobody had wanted. Wards of a state that could barely feed them, much less nurture them.
"You can't change laws without first changing human nature," one of the nurses often said as she looked out over the crowd of crying infants. Her name was Greta.
Whenever she said something like that, there was always another nurse within earshot who was far more accepting of the system and would counter with, "You can't change human nature without first changing the law." Nurse Greta wouldn't argue. She'd just grunt and walk away. Which was worse, Risa often wondered, to have tens of thousands of babies that no one wanted, or to silently make them go away before they were even born? On different days, Risa had different answers. Nurse Greta was old enough to remember the days before the war, but she rarely spoke of them. All her attention was given to her job, which was a formidable one, since there was only one nurse for every 50 babies.
"In a place like this, you have to practice triage," she told Risa,
referring to how, in an emergency, a nurse had to choose which patients would get medical attention.
"Love the ones you can," Nurse Greta told her. "Pray for the rest."
Risa took the advice to heart and selected a handful of favorites to give extra attention. These were the ones Risa named herself, instead of letting the randomizing computer name them. Risa liked to think she had been named by a human being instead of a computer. After all, her name wasn't all that common.
"It's short for sonrisa," a Hispanic kid once told her. "That's Spanish for smile."
Risa didn't know if she had any Hispanic blood in her, but she liked to think she did. It connected her to her name.
"What are you thinking about?" Connor asks, tearing her out of her thoughts and bringing her back to the uneasy reality around them. "None of your business."
Connor doesn't look at her. He seems to be focusing on a big rust spot on the wall, thinking,
"You okay about the baby?" he asks.
"Of course." Her tone is intentionally indignant, as if the question itself offended her.
"Hannah will give her a good home," Connor says. "Better than us, that's for sure. And better than that beady-eyed cow who got storked."
He hesitates for a moment, then says,
Taking that baby was a massive screw-up, I know. But it ended okay for us, right? And it definitely ended better for the baby. Don't screw up like that again, is all Risa says.
Roland, sitting toward the front, turns to the driver and asks, Where are we going?
You're asking the wrong guy, the driver answers. They give me an address, I go there. I look the other way, and I get paid.
This is how it works, says another kid who had already been in the truck when it arrived at Sonia's. We get shuffled around. One safe house for a few days, then another, and then another. Each one is a little bit closer to where we're going.
You gonna tell us where that is? Asks Roland.
The kid looks around, hoping someone else might answer for him, but no one comes to his aid. So he says, Well, it's only what I hear, but they say we end up in a place called the graveyard.
No response from the kids, just the rattling of the truck.
The graveyard. The thought of it makes Risa even colder. Even though she's curled up knees to chest, arms wrapped tight around her like a straitjacket, she's still freezing.
Connor must hear the chattering of her teeth because he puts his arm around her.
I'm cold too, he says. Body heat, right?
And although she has an urge to push him away, she finds herself leaning into him until she can feel his heartbeat in her ears.
Part 3. Transit. 2003, Ukrainian Maternity Hospital Number 6. The BBC has spoken to mothers from the city of Kharkiv who say they gave birth to healthy babies only to have them taken by maternity staff. In 2003, the authorities agreed to exhume around 30 bodies from a cemetery used by Maternity Hospital Number 6. One campaigner was allowed into the autopsy to gather video evidence. She has given that footage to the BBC and Council of Europe. In its report, the council describes a general culture of trafficking of children snatched at birth, and a wall of silence from hospital staff upward over their fate. The pictures show organs, including brains, have been stripped, and some bodies dismembered. A senior British forensic pathologist says he is very concerned to see bodies in pieces, as that is not standard post-mortem practice. It could possibly be a result of harvesting stem cells from bone marrow. Hospital Number 6 denies the allegations. Story by Matthew Hill, BBC health correspondent, from BBC News at bbc.com. http://news.bbc.co.uk/go/pr/fr/-2/hi/europe/617-1083.stm. Published 2006/12/09/3450 GMT. Copyright BBC 2006.
21. Lev.
Ain't no one gonna tell you what's in your heart, he tells Lev. You gotta find that out for yourself.
Lev and his new travel companion walk along train tracks, surrounded by thick, brushy terrain.
You got it in your heart to run from unwinding? Ain't no one can tell you it's the wrong thing to do, even if it is against the law. The good Lord wouldn't have put it in your heart if it wasn't right. You listening, Fry? 'Cause this here is wisdom. Wisdom you can take to the grave, then dig it up again when you need some solace. Solace, that means comfort.
I know what solace means, says Lev, peeved by the mention of the good Lord, who hasn't done much for Lev lately, except confuse things. The kid is 15, and his name is Cyrus Finch, although he doesn't go by that name.
No one calls me Cyrus, he had told Lev shortly after they met. I go by Sci-Fi.
And since Sci-Fi is partial to nicknames, he calls Lev Fry, short for Small Fry. Since it has the same number of letters as Lev, he says it's appropriate. Lev doesn't want to burst his bubble by pointing out that his full name is Levi. Sci-Fi enjoys hearing himself talk.
I make my own roads in life, he tells Lev. That's how come we're traveling the rails instead of some dumb old country road.
Sci-fi is Umber.
They used to call us Black. Can you imagine? Then there was this artist dude, mixed race himself. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. He got famous, though, for painting people of African ancestry in the Deep South. The color he used most was umber. People liked that a whole lot better, so it stuck. Bet you didn't know where the word came from, did you, Fry? Following right along, they started calling so-called white people Sienna. After another paint color. Better words. Didn't have no value judgment to them. Of course, it's not like racism is gone completely. But as my dad's like to say, the veneer of civilization got itself a second coat. You like that, Fry? The veneer of civilization?
He slowly sweeps his hand in the air as he says it, like he's feeling the fine finish of a table.
My dads are always saying stuff like that.
Sci-fi's a runaway, although he claims not to be.
I ain't no runaway. I'm a run too.
He had told Lev when they first met, although he won't tell Lev where he's running to. When Lev asked, Sci-fi shook his head and said,
"Information shall be given on a need-to-know basis."
Well, he can keep his secret, because Lev doesn't care where he's going. The simple fact that he has a destination is enough for Lev. It's more than Lev has. Destination implies a future. If this umber-skinned boy can lend Lev that much, it's worth it to travel with him. They had met at a mall. Hunger had driven Lev there. He had hidden in dark, lonely places for almost 2 days after he lost Connor and Risa. With no experience being a street rat, he went hungry. But eventually, hunger turns anyone into a master of survival. The mall was a mecca for a newborn street rat. The food court was full of amazingly wasteful people. The trick, Lev discovered, was to find people who bought more food than they could possibly eat, and then wait until they were done. About half the time, they just left it on the table. Those were the ones Lev went after. Because he might have been hungry enough to eat table scraps, but he was still too proud to rifle through the trash. While Lev was finishing off some cheerleader's pizza, he heard a voice in his ear.
"You ain't gotta be eating other folks' garbage, foo!"
Lev froze, certain it was a security guard ready to haul him away. But it was only this tall umber kid with a funny grin, wearing attitude like it was a cologne.
"Let me show you how it's done."
Then he went to a pretty girl who was working at the Wicked Walk Chinese food concession, flirted with her for a few minutes, then left with nothing. No food, no drink, nothing.
"I think I'll stick to leftovers," Lev had told him.
"Patience, my man. See, it's getting on toward closing time. All these places by law gotta get rid of all the food they made today. They can't keep it and reuse it tomorrow. So where do you think that food goes? I'll tell you where it goes. It goes home with the last shift. But the people who work these places ain't gonna eat that stuff on account of they're sick to death of it. See that girl I was talking to? She likes me. I told her I worked at Shirt Bonanza downstairs and could get her some overstock, maybe."
"Do you work there?"
"No! Are you even listening to me? So anywho, right before closing, I'm gonna get myself over to the Wicked Walk again. I'll give her a smile, and I'll be all like, 'Hey, what you gonna do with all that leftover food?' And she'll be all like,
'What you got in mind?'
And 5 minutes later, I'm walking away in orange chicken heaven, with enough to feed an army."
And sure enough, it happened exactly like he said it would. Lev was amazed.
"Stick with me," Sci-Fi had said, putting his fist in the air. "And as God is my witness, you will never go hungry again."
Then he added, "That's where I'm going with the wind."
"I know," said Lev, which, in fact, he didn't.
Lev had agreed to go with him because he knew the two filled a need in each other. Sci-Fi was like a preacher with no flock. He couldn't exist without an audience, and Lev needed someone who could fill his head with ideas to replace the lifetime of ideas that had been taken from him. A day later, Lev's shoes are worn and his muscles are sore. The memory of Risa and Connor is still a fresh wound, and it doesn't want to heal. Chances are, they were caught. Chances are, they've been unwound. All because of him. Does that make him an accomplice to murder?
How could it, when unwinds aren't really dead?
He doesn't know whose voice is in his head anymore. His father's? Pastor Dan's? It just makes him angry. He'd rather hear Sci-Fi's voice outside of his head than whatever voices were inside. The terrain around them hasn't changed much since they left town. Eye-high shrubs and a smattering of trees. Some of the growth is evergreen, some of it yellow, turning brown. Weeds grow up between the train tracks, but not too tall.
Any weed dumb enough to grow tall ain't got no chance. It gets decapitated by the next train that comes through. Decapitated, that means head cut off.
I know what decapitated means, and you can stop talking that way, all double negatives and stuff.
Sci-Fi stops right there in the middle of the railroad tracks and stares at Lev like he's trying to melt him with his eyes.
You got a problem with the way I talk? You got a problem with an old-world umber patois?
I do when it's fake.
What you talking about, foo?
It's obvious. I'll bet people never even said things like foo, except on dumb pre-war TV shows and stuff. You're speaking wrong on purpose.
Wrong? What makes it wrong? It's classic, just like those TV shows. And I ain't appreciating you disrespecting my patois. Patois means,
I know what it means, Lev says, even though he isn't entirely sure.
I ain't stupid.
Sci-Fi puts up an accusing finger like a lawyer.
Aha! You said ain't. Now who's talking wrong?
That doesn't count. I said it because it's all I hear from you. After a while, I can't help but sound like you.
At that, Sci-Fi grins.
Yeah, he says. Ain't that the truth? Old world umber is contagious. It's dominant. And talking the talk don't make a person dumb. I have you know I got the highest reading and writing score in my school, Fry. But I gotta respect my ancestors and all they went through so I could be here. Sure, I can talk like you, but I choose not to. It's like art, you know? Picasso had to prove to the world he can paint the right way before he goes putting both eyes on one side of a face and noses sticking out of kneecaps and stuff. See, if you paint wrong because that's the best you can do, you just a chump. But you do it because you want to, then you're an artist.
He smiles at Lev.
That's a bit of Sci-Fi wisdom right there, Fry. You can take that to the grave and dig it up when you need it.
Sci-Fi turns and spits out a piece of gum that hits a train rail and sticks there. Then he shoves another piece in his mouth.
Anyway, my dad's got no problem with it, and they're Lily Sienna like you.
They?
Sci had said dads before, but Lev had figured it was just some more old umber slang.
Yeah? Says Sci-Fi with a shrug. I got two. Ain't no thang.
Lev tries his best to process this. Of course, he's heard of male parenting, or yin families, as they're currently called. But in the sheltered structure of his life, such things always belong to an alternate universe. Sci-Fi, however, doesn't even catch Lev's surprise. He's still on his brag jag.
Yeah, I got myself an IQ of 155. You know that, Fry? Course not. How would you know?
Then he hesitates.
It went down a few points, though, on account of the accident. I was on my bike and got hit by some damn fool in a Mercedes.
He points to a scar on the side of his head.
What a mess! Splattered, you know? I was nearly roadkill. It turned my right temporal lobe into jello.
He shivers as he thinks about it, then shrugs.
But brain damage ain't a problem like it used to be. They just replaced the brain tissue and you're as good as new. My dad's even paid off the surgeon so I get an entire temporal lobe from an unwind. No offense. Rather than getting a bunch of brain bits like people are supposed to get.
Lev knows about that. His sister, Kara, has epilepsy. So they replaced a small part of her brain with 100 tiny brain bits. It took care of the problem, and she didn't seem any worse for it. It had never occurred to Lev where those tiny pieces of brain tissue might have come from.
See? Brain bits work okay, but they don't work great, Sci-Fi explains. It's like putting spackle over a hole in the wall. No matter how well you do it, that wall ain't never gonna be as good. So my dad's made sure I got an entire temporal lobe from a single donor. But that kid wasn't as smart as me. He wasn't no dummy, but he didn't have the 155. The last brain scan put me at 130. That's in the top 5% of the population, and still considered genius. just not with a capital G. What's your IQ?
He asks Lev.
Are you a dim bulb or a high wattage?
Lev sighs. I don't know. My parents don't believe in intelligence scans. It's kind of a religious thing. Everyone's equal in God's eyes and all that.
Oh, you come from one of those families.
Sci-Fi takes a good look at him.
So if they all high and mighty, why are they unwinding you?
Although Lev doesn't want to get into it, he figures Sci-Fi is the only friend he's got. Might as well tell him the truth.
I'm a tithe.
Sci-Fi looks at him with eyes all wide, like Lev just told him he was God himself.
Damn! So you all holy and stuff?
Not anymore.
Sci-Fi nods and purses his lips, saying nothing for a while. They walk along the tracks. The railroad ties change from wood to stone, and the gravel on the side of the tracks now seems better maintained.
We just crossed the state line, Sci-Fi says.
Lev would ask him which state they've crossed into, but he doesn't want to sound stupid. Any spot where multiple tracks merge or diverge, there's a little two-story shack standing there like a displaced lighthouse. A railroad switch house. There are plenty of them along this stretch of the line, and these are the places Lev and Sci-Fi find shelter each night.
Aren't you afraid someone from the railroads will find us here?
Lev asks as they approach one of the sorry-looking structures.
Nah, they ain't used anymore, Sci-Fi tells him. The whole system's automated. Been that way for years. But it costs too much to tear all those switch houses down. Guess they figure nature will eventually tear them down for free.
The switch house is padlocked, but a padlock is only as strong as the door it's on. And this door had been routed by termites. A single kick rips the padlock hasp from the wood, and the door flies inward to a shower of dust and dead spiders. Upstairs is an 8x8 room, windows on all four sides. It's freezing. Sci-Fi has an expensive-looking winter coat that keeps him warm at night. Lev only has a puffy, fiber-filled jacket that he stole from a chair at the mall the other day. Sci-Fi had turned his nose up when he saw Lev take that jacket, just before they left the mall.
Stealing's for lowlives, Sci had said. If you got class, you don't steal what you need. You get other people to give it to you of their own free will. Just like I did back at the Chinese place. It's all about being smart and being smooth. You'll learn.
Lev's stolen jacket is white, and he hates it. All his life he'd worn white, a pristine absence of color that defined him. But now there was no comfort in wearing it. They eat well that night, thanks to Lev, who finally had his own survivalist brainstorm. It involved small animals killed by passing trains.
I ain't eating no track kill,
Sci-Fi insisted when Lev had suggested it.
Those things could have been rotting out here for weeks, for all we know.
No, Lev told him. Here's what we do. We walk a few miles down the tracks, marking each dead critter with a stick. Then, when the next train comes through, we backtrack. Anything we find that's not marked is fresh.
Granted, it was a fairly disgusting idea on the surface, but it was really no different from hunting, if your weapon were a diesel engine. They build a small fire beside the switch house and dine on roast rabbit and armadillo, which doesn't taste as bad as Lev thought it would. In the end, meat is meat, and barbecue does for armadillo exactly what it does for steak.
Smorgasbash!
Sci-Fi decides to call this hunting method as they eat.
That's what I call creative problem-solving. Maybe you're a genius after all, Fry.
It feels good to have Sci's approval.
Hey, is today Thursday? Says Lev, just realizing. I think it's Thanksgiving.
Well, Fry, we're alive. That's plenty to be thankful for.
That night, up in the small room of the switch house, Sci-Fi asks the big question.
Why'd your parents tithe you, Fry?
One of the good things about being with Sci-Fi is that he talks about himself a lot. It keeps Lev from having to think about his own life. Except, of course, when Sci asks. Lev answers him with silence, pretending to be asleep. And if there's one thing he knows Sci-Fi can't stand, it's silence. So he fills it himself.
Were you a stork baby, is that it? They didn't want you in the first place and couldn't wait to get rid of you?
Lev keeps his eyes closed and doesn't move.
Well, I was stalked, Cy says. My dad's got me on the doorstep the first day of summer. No big deal. They were ready to have a family anyway. In fact, they were so pleased, they finally made it official and got themselves married.
Lev opens his eyes, curious enough to admit he's still awake.
But after the Heartland War, didn't they make it illegal for men to get married?
They didn't get married, they got married.
What's the difference?
Sci-Fi looks at him like he's a moron.
The letter M? Anyway, in case you're wondering, I'm not like my dad's. My compass points to girls, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, mine does too.
What he doesn't tell Sci-Fi is that the closest he's ever been to a date, or even kissing a girl, was the slow dancing at his tithing party. The thought of the party brings a sudden and sharp jolt of anxiety that makes him want to scream, so he squeezes his eyes tight and forces that explosive feeling to go away. Everything from Lev's old life is like that now, a ticking time bomb in his head.
Forget that life, he tells himself. You're not that boy anymore.
What are your parents like?
Sci-Fi asks.
I hate them,
Lev says, surprised that he said it. Surprised that he means it.
That's not what I asked.
This time, Sci isn't taking silence for an answer, so Lev tells him as best he can.
My parents, he begins, do everything they're supposed to. They pay their taxes, they go to church, they vote the way their friends expect them to vote, and think what they're supposed to think, and they send us to schools that raise us to think exactly like they do.
Doesn't sound too terrible to me.
It wasn't, says Lev, his discomfort building. But they loved God more than they loved me, and I hate them for it. So I guess that means I'm going to hell.
Tell you what, when you get there, save a room for me, okay?
Why? What makes you think you're going there?
I don't, but just in case. Gotta plan your contingencies, right?
2 days later, they find themselves in the town of Scottsburg, Indiana. Well, at least Lev finally knows what state they're in. He wonders if maybe this is Sci-Fi's destination, but Sci hasn't said anything either way. They've left the railroad tracks, and Sci-Fi tells Lev they have to go south on county roads until they can find tracks heading in that direction. Sci hasn't been acting right. It began the night before. Something in his voice. Something in his eyes, too. At first, Lev thought it was his imagination, but now, in the pale light of the autumn day, it's clear that Sci-Fi isn't himself. He's lagging behind Lev instead of leading. His stride is all off, more like a shuffle than a strut. It makes Lev anxious in a way he hasn't been since before he met Sci-Fi.
Are you ever going to tell me where we're going?
Lev asks, figuring that maybe they're close, and maybe that's why Sci's acting weird. Sci-Fi hesitates, weighing the wisdom of saying anything. Finally, he says,
We're going to Joplin. That's in southwest Missouri, so we still got a long way to go.
In the back of his mind, Lev registers that Sci-Fi has completely dropped his old Umber way of talking. Now he sounds like any other kid Lev might have known back home. But there's also something dark and throaty about his voice now, too. Vaguely menacing. Like the voice of a werewolf before it turns.
What's in Joplin?
Lev asks.
Nothing for you to worry about.
But Lev is beginning to worry. Because when Sci-Fi gets where he's going, Lev will be alone again. This journey was easier when he didn't know the destination. As they walk, Lev can tell Sci's mind is somewhere else. Maybe it's in Joplin. What could be there? Maybe a girlfriend moved there. Maybe he had tracked down his birth mother. Lev has worked up a dozen reasons for Sci-Fi to be on this trip, and there's probably a dozen more he hasn't even thought of. There's a main street in Scottsburg trying to be quaint but just looking tired. It's late morning as they move through town. Restaurants are gearing up for the lunch crowd.
So, are you going to use your charms to get us a free meal, or is it my turn to try?
Lev asks. He turns to Sci. But he's not there. A quick scan of the shops behind him and Lev sees a door swinging closed. It's a Christmas store, its windows all done up in green and red decorations, plastic reindeer, and cotton snow. Lev can't imagine Sai has gone in there, but when he peers in the window, there he is, looking around like a customer. With the weird way Sci-Fi has been acting, Lev has no choice but to go in as well. It's warm in the store and it smells of artificial pine. It's the kind of scent they put on cardboard air fresheners. There are fully trimmed aluminum Christmas trees all around, displaying all sorts of holiday decorations, each tree with a different theme. In another time and place, Lev would have loved wandering through a store like this. A saleswoman eyes them suspiciously from behind the counter. Lev grabs Sai's shoulder.
Come on, let's get out of here.
But Sai shakes him off and goes over to a tree that's decorated all in glittering gold. He seems mesmerized by all the bulbs and tinsel. There's the slightest twitch right beneath his left eye.
Sai? Whispers Lev. Come on, we have to get to Joplin. Remember? Joplin?
But Sai's not moving. The saleswoman comes over. She wears a holiday sweater and a holiday smile.
Can I help you find something?
No, says Lev. We were just leaving.
A nutcracker, says Sai.
I'm looking for a nutcracker for my mom.
Oh, they're on the back wall.
The woman turns to look across the store, and the moment she does, Sai picks a dangling gold bauble from the glittering tree and slips it into his coat pocket. Lev just stands there, stunned. Sai doesn't even spare Lev a glance as he follows the woman to the back wall, where they discuss nutcrackers. There's a panic brewing deep down in Lev now, slowly fighting its way to the surface. Sai and the woman chat for a few moments more, then Sai thanks her and comes back to the front of the store.
I've got to get more money from home,
he says in his Sai, not Sai voice.
I think my mom will like the blue one.
You don't have a mom, Lev wants to say. But he doesn't, because all that matters now is getting out of the shop.
All right, then, says the saleswoman. You have a nice day.
Sai leaves, and Lev makes sure he's right behind him, just in case Sai suddenly has a phantom urge to go back into the store and take something else. Then, the moment the door closes behind them, Sci-Fi takes off. He doesn't just run, he ejects, like he's trying to burst out of his own skin. He bolts down the block, then into the street, then back again. Cars honk, a truck nearly mows him down. He darts in random directions like a balloon losing air, and then he disappears into an alley far down the street. This is not about a gold Christmas bulb. It can't be. It's a meltdown. It's a seizure, the nature of which Lev can't even begin to guess.
I should just let him go, Lev thinks. Let him go, then run in the opposite direction and not look back.
Lev could survive on his own now. He's gotten street smart enough. He could do it without Sci-Fi. But there was that look about Sai before he ran. Desperation. It was just like the look in Connor's face the moment he pulled Lev out of his father's comfortable sedan. Lev had turned on Connor. He will not turn on Sci-Fi. With a pace and stride far steadier than Sci-Fi's, Lev crosses the street and makes his way down the alley.
Sci-Fi?
He calls, loud enough to be heard but not loud enough to draw attention.
Sai!
He glances in dumpsters and doorways.
Cyrus, where are you?
He comes to the end of the alley and looks left and right. No sign of him. Then, as he's about to lose hope, he hears,
Fry?
He turns his head and listens again.
Fry, over here.
This time he can tell where it's coming from. A playground to his right. Green plastic and steel poles painted blue. There are no children playing. The only sign of life is the tip of Sci-Fi's shoe poking out from behind the slide. Lev crosses through a hedge, steps down into the sand that surrounds the playground, and circles the apparatus until Sci-Fi comes into view. Lev almost wants to back away from what he sees. Sai is curled knees to chest like a baby. The left side of his face is twitching, and his left hand quivers like gelatin. He grimaces as if he's in pain.
What is it? What's wrong? Tell me. Maybe I can help you.
Nothing, Sci-Fi hisses. I'll be all right.
But to Lev, he looks like he's dying. In his shaking left hand, Sci-Fi holds the ornament he stole.
I didn't steal this, he says.
Sci,
I said I didn't steal this!
He smashes the heel of his right hand against the side of his head.
It wasn't me!
Okay, whatever you say.
Lev looks around to make sure they're unobserved. Sci quiets down a bit.
Cyrus Finch doesn't steal. Never did, never will. It's not my style.
He says it, even as he looks at the evidence right there in his hand. But in a second, the evidence is gone. Sci-Fi raises his right fist and smashes it into his left palm, shattering the bulb. Gold glass tinkles to the ground. Blood begins to ooze from his left palm and right knuckles.
Sci, your hand.
Don't worry about that, he says. I want you to do something for me, Fry. Do it before I change my mind.
Lev nods.
See my coat over there? I want you to look in the pockets.
Sci-Fi's heavy coat is a few yards away, tossed over the seat of a swing. Lev goes to the swing set and picks up the coat. He reaches into an inside pocket and finds, of all things, a gold cigarette lighter. He pulls it out.
Is that it, Sci? You want a cigarette?
If a cigarette would bring Sci-Fi out of this, Lev would be the first to light it for him. There are things far more illegal than cigarettes anyway.
Check the other pockets.
Lev searches the other pockets for a pack of cigarettes, but there are none. Instead, he finds a small treasure trove. Jeweled earrings, watches, a gold necklace, a diamond bracelet. Things that shimmer and shine even in the dim daylight.
Sci, what did you do?
I already told you it wasn't me. Now go take all that stuff and get rid of it. Get rid of it and don't let me see where you put it.
Then he covers his eyes like it's a game of hide-and-seek.
Go! Before he changes my mind!
Lev pulls everything out of the pocket and, cradling it in his arms, runs to the far end of the playground. He digs in the cold sand and drops it all in, kicking sand back over it. When he's done, he smooths it over with the side of his shoe and drops a scattering of leaves above it. He goes back to Sci-Fi, who's sitting there just like Lev left him. Hands over his face.
It's done, Lev says. You can look now.
When Sci takes his hands away, there's blood all over his face from the cuts on his hands. Sci stares at his hands, then looks at Lev helplessly. Like, well, like a kid who just got hurt in the playground. Lev half expects him to cry.
You wait here, Lev says. I'll go get some bandages.
He knows he'll have to steal them. He wonders what Pastor Dan would say about all the things he's been stealing lately.
Thank you, Fry, Sci says. You did good, and I ain't gonna forget it.
The old umber lilt is back in his voice. The twitching has stopped.
Sure thing, says Lev with a comforting smile, and he heads off to find a pharmacy.
What Sci-Fi doesn't know is that Lev has kept a single diamond bracelet, which he now hides in the inside pocket of his not-so-white jacket. Lev finds them a place to sleep that night. It's the best they've had yet, a motel room. Finding it wasn't all that hard to do. He scouted out a run-down motel without many cars out front. Then it was just a matter of finding an unlocked bathroom window in an unoccupied room. As long as they kept the curtains drawn and the lights off, no one would know they were there.
My genius keeps rubbing off on you,
Sci-Fi tells him. Sighs back to his old self, like the incident that morning never happened. Only it did happen, and they both know it. Outside, they hear a car door open. Lev and Sci prepare to bolt if a key turns in the motel room lock, but it's another door they hear opening a few rooms away. Sci shakes out his tension, but Lev doesn't relax. Not yet.
I want to know about today,
Lev says. It's not a question. It's a request. Sci is unconcerned.
Ancient history, he says.
Leave the past in the past and live for the moment. That's wisdom you can take to the grave and dig it up when you need it.
What if I dig it up right now?
Lev takes a moment to let it sink in. Then he reaches into his pocket and pulls out the diamond bracelet. He holds it in front of him, making sure the streetlight spilling through a slit in the curtains catches the diamonds so they glisten.
Where'd you get that?
Sci-Fi's voice has lost all the playfulness it had only a second ago.
I kept it, Lev says calmly. I thought it might come in handy.
I told you to get rid of it.
It wasn't yours to get rid of. After all, you said it yourself. You didn't steal it.
Lev twists the bracelet so a diamond refracts a sparkle of light right into Sci-Fi's eye. Without the room lights on, Lev can't see much, but he can swear he sees Sci-Fi's cheek starting to twitch. Sci stands up, looming over Lev. Lev stands as well, a full head shorter than Sci-Fi.
You take that out of my face, says Sci-Fi. Oh, I swear I'm gonna pound you into pork rinds.
Lev thinks he might actually do it, too. Sci-Fi clenches his fists. With the bandages, he looks like a boxer, hands wrapped before putting on the gloves. Still, Lev doesn't back down. He just dangles the bracelet. It sends little twinkling lights flitting around the room like a lazy disco ball.
I'll put it away if you tell me why this bracelet and all those other things wound up in your pockets.
Put it away first, then I'll tell you.
Fair enough.
Lev slips the bracelet back into his pocket and waits, but Sci-Fi isn't talking, so Lev gives him a little prompt.
What's his name? Lev asks. Or is it a she?
Sci-Fi's shoulders slump in defeat. He crumples into a chair. Lev can't see his face at all now in the darkness, so Lev listens closely to his voice. As long as it still sounds like Sci's voice, he knows that Sci's okay. Lev sits himself on the edge of the bed, a few feet away from Sci, and listens.
It's a he, Sci says. I don't know his name. He must have kept his name in another part of his brain. All I got was his right temporal lobe. That's only an eighth of the cerebral cortex, so I'm 7/8 me and 1/8 him.
I figured that was it.
Lev had realized what was going on with Sci even before he stole the bandages from the pharmacy. Sci gave him the clue himself.
Do it before he changes my mind,
Sci had said.
So, he was a shoplifter?
He had problems. I guess those problems are why his parents had him unwound in the first place. And now one of his problems is mine.
Wow, that sucks.
Sci-Fi laughs bitterly at that.
Yeah, Fry, it does.
It's kind of like what happened to my brother Ray, says Lev. He went to this government auction thing, ended up with 10 acres on a lake, and it cost next to nothing. Then he finds out that the land came with a bunker full of toxic chemicals seeping into the ground. Now he owned it, so now it was his problem. Cost him almost 10 times the cost of the land to clean up the chemicals.
Sucker,
says Sci.
Yeah, but then, those chemicals weren't in his brain.
Sci looks down for a moment.
He's not a bad kid. He's just hurting. Hurting real bad.
The way Sci's talking, it's like the kid is still there, right in the room with him.
He's got this urge about him to grab things. Like an addiction, you know? Shiny things, mostly. It's not like he really wants them. It's just that he kinda needs to snap them up. I figure he's a kleptomaniac. That means... Oh, hell, you know what it means.
So he talks to you?
No, not really. I didn't get the part of him that uses words. I get feelings, mostly. Sometimes images. But usually just feelings. Urges. When I get an urge, I don't know where it's coming from. I know it's from him. Like the time I saw this Irish setter on the street and I wanted to go over and pet it. I'm not a dog person, see, but all of a sudden I just had to pet that pooch.
Now that Sci's talking about it, he can't stop. It's all spilling out like water over a dam.
Petting that dog was one thing, but then stealing is another. The stealing makes me mad. I mean, here I am, a law-abiding citizen, never took nothing that didn't belong to me my whole life, and now I'm stuck with this? There's people out there, like that lady in the Christmas store. They see an umber kid like me, and they automatically assume I'm up to no good. And now, thanks to this kid in my head, they're right. And you want to know what's funny? The kid was Lily Sienna like you. Blonde hair, blue eyes.
Hearing that surprises Lev. Not the description, but the fact that Sai can describe him at all.
You know what he looked like?
Sci-Fi nods. I can see him sometimes. It's hard, but sometimes I can. I close my eyes and imagine myself looking into a mirror. Usually I just see myself reflected, but once in a while I can see him. It's only for an instant. Kind of like trying to catch a bolt of lightning after you've already seen the flash. But other people, they don't see him when he steals. It's me they see. My hands grabbing.
The people who matter know it's not you. Your dad's.
They don't even know about this, Sai says. They think they did me a favor sticking me with this brain chunk. If I told them about it, they'd feel guilty until the end of time, so I can't tell them.
Lev doesn't know what to say. He wishes he'd never brought it up. He wishes he hadn't insisted on knowing. But most of all, he wishes Sai didn't have to deal with this. He's a good guy. He deserves a better break.
And this kid, he doesn't even understand he's a part of me, Sai says. It's like those ghosts that don't know they're dead. He keeps trying to be him and can't understand why the rest of him ain't there.
All of a sudden, Lev realizes something.
He lived in Joplin, didn't he?
Sai doesn't answer for a long time. That's how Lev knows it's true. Finally, Sai says,
There are things he's still got locked up in my brain that I can't get at. All I know is that he's got to get to Joplin, so I got to get there too. Once we're there, maybe he'll leave me alone.
Sci-Fi shifts his shoulders, not in a shrug, but in an uncomfortable roll, like when you get an itch in your back or a sudden shiver.
I don't want to talk about him no more. His 1/8 feels a whole lot bigger when I spend time hanging around in his gray matter.
Lev wants to put his arm around Sai's shoulder like an older brother to comfort him, but he just can't bring himself to do it. So instead he pulls the blanket from the bed and wraps it around Sai as he sits in the chair.
What's this all about?
Just making sure you two stay warm. And then he says, Don't worry about anything. I've got it all under control.
Sci-Fi laughs.
You? You can't even take care of yourself, and now you think you're going to take care of me? If it weren't for me, you'd still be chowing down on other folks' garbage back at the mall.
That's right. But you helped me. Now it's my turn to do the same for you. And I'm going to get you to Joplin.
22. Risa. Megan Ward watches everything around her closely and carefully. She's seen enough at Steho to know that survival rests on how observant you are. For 3 weeks, she, Connor, and a mixed bag of unwinds have been shuttled from one safe house to another. It's maddening, for there seems to be no end in sight to this relentless underground railroad of refugees. There are dozens of kids being moved around, but there are never more than 5 or 6 at a time in any given safe house, and Risa rarely sees the same kids twice. The only reason she and Connor have been able to stay together is because they pose as a couple. It's practical, and it serves both their interests. What's that expression? The devil you know is better than the one you don't. Finally, they're dumped in a huge, empty warehouse in a thundering air traffic zone. Cheap realty for hiding unwanted kids. It's a Spartan building with a corrugated steel roof that shakes so badly when a plane passes overhead, she half expects it to collapse. There are almost 30 kids here when they arrive. Many of them are kids Risa and Connor had come across over the past few weeks. This is a holding tank, she realizes, a place where all the kids are warehoused in preparation for some final journey. There are chains on the doors to keep anyone unwanted out, and to keep anyone too rebellious in. There are space heaters that are useless, since all the heat is lost to the high warehouse roof. There's only one bathroom with a broken lock, and, unlike many of the safe houses, there's no shower, so personal hygiene is put on hold the moment they arrive. Put all that together with a gang of scared, angry kids, and you've got a powder keg waiting to explode. Perhaps that's why the people who run the show all carry guns. There are 4 men and 3 women in charge, all of them militarized versions of the folks who, like Sonia, run the safe houses. Everyone calls them the Fatigues. Not just because they have a penchant toward khaki military clothing, but also because they always seem exhausted. Even so, they have a high-tension determination about them that Risa admires. A handful of new kids arrives almost every day. Risa watches each group of arrivals with interest and notices that Connor does too. She knows why.
You're looking for Lev too, aren't you?
She finally says to him. He shrugs. Maybe I'm just looking for the Akron AWOL like everyone else. That makes Risa chuckle. Even in the safe houses, they had heard the inflated rumors of an AWOL from Akron who escaped from a juvie cop by turning his own trank pistol against him.
Maybe he's on his way here,
kids would whisper around the warehouse, like they were talking about a celebrity. Risa has no idea how the rumor started, since it was never in the news. She's also a bit annoyed that she's not included in the rumor. It ought to be a Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing. The rumor mill is definitely sexist.
So are you ever going to tell them you're the Akron AWOL?
She quietly asks Connor.
I don't want that kind of attention. Besides, they wouldn't believe me anyway. They're all saying the Akron AWOL is this big buff superhero. I don't want to disappoint them.
Lev doesn't show up with any of the batches of new kids. The only thing that arrives with them is an increase of tension. 43 kids by the end of their first week, and there's still 1 bathroom, no shower, and no answer as to how long this will last. Restlessness hangs as heavy as body odor in the air. The Fatigues do their best to keep them all fed and occupied, if only to minimize friction. There are a few crates of games, incomplete decks of cards, and dog-eared books that no library wanted. There are no electronics, no balls, nothing that would create or encourage noise.
If people out there hear you, then you're all done for, the Fatigues remind them as often as they can.
Risa wonders if the Fatigues have lives separate and apart from saving unwinds, or if this endeavor is their life's work.
Why are you doing this for us?
Risa asked one of them during their 2nd week. The Fatigue had been almost rote in her answer, like giving a soundbite to a reporter.
Saving you and others like you is an act of conscience, the woman had said. Doing it is its own reward.
The Fatigues all talk like that. Big picture speak, Risa calls it. Seeing the whole and none of the parts. It's not just in their speech, but in their eyes as well. When they look at Risa, she can tell they don't really see her. They seem to see the mob of unwinds more as a concept rather than a collection of anxious kids. And so they miss all the subtle social tremors that shake things just as powerfully as the jets shake the roof. By the end of the 2nd week, Risa has a pretty good idea where trouble is brewing. It all revolves around 1 kid she hoped she'd never see again. But he had turned up shortly after she and Connor arrived. Roland. Of all the kids here, he is by far the most potentially dangerous. The troubling thing is that Connor hasn't exactly been the image of emotional stability himself this past week. He'd been all right in the safe houses. He'd held his temper. He hadn't done anything too impulsive or irrational. Here, however, in the midst of so many kids, he's different. He's irritable and defiant. The slightest thing can set him off. He'd been in 6 fights already. She knows this must be why his parents chose to have him unwound. A firestorm temper can drive some parents to desperate measures. Common sense tells Risa to distance herself from him. Their alliance has been one of necessity, but there's no reason to ally herself with him anymore. Yet, day after day, she keeps finding herself drawn to him, and worried about him. She approaches him shortly after breakfast one day, determined to open his eyes to a clear and present danger. He's sitting by himself, etching a portrait into the concrete floor with a rusty nail. Risa wishes she could say it was good, but Connor's not much of an artist. It disappoints her, because she desperately wants to find something redeeming about him. If he were an artist, they could relate on a creative level. She could talk to him about her passion for music, and he would get it. As it is, she doesn't think he even knows or cares that she plays piano.
What are you drawing? She asks.
Just a girl I knew back home, he says.
Risa silently suffocates her jealousy in a quick emotional vacuum.
Someone you cared about?
Sort of. Risa takes a better look at the sketch.
Her eyes are too big for her face.
I guess that's because it's her eyes that I remember most.
And her forehead's too low. The way you've drawn it, she'd have no room for a brain.
Yeah, well, she wasn't all that bright.
Risa laughs at that, and it makes Connor smile. When he smiles, it's hard to imagine he's the same guy who got into all those fights. She gauges whether or not he'd be open to hear what she has to tell him. He looks away from her.
Is there something you want, or are you just an art critic today?
I was wondering why you're sitting by yourself.
Ah, so you're also my shrink.
We're supposed to be a couple. If we're going to keep up the image, you can't be entirely antisocial.
Connor looks out over the groups of kids, busy in various morning activities. Risa follows his gaze. There's a group of kids who hate the world and spend all day spewing venom. There's a mouth-breathing kid who does nothing but read the same comic book over and over again. Mai is paired off with a glum, spike-haired boy named Vincent, who's all leather and body piercings. He must be her soulmate, because they make out all day long, drawing a cluster of other kids who sit there and watch.
I don't want to be social, Connor says. I don't like the kids here.
Why?
Asks Risa.
They're too much like you?
They're losers.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
He gives her a half-hearted, dirty look, then looks down at his drawing. But she can tell he's not thinking about the girl. His head is somewhere else.
If I'm off by myself, then I don't get into fights.
He puts down the nail, giving up on his etching.
I don't know what gets into me. Maybe it's all the voices. Maybe it's all the bodies moving all around me. Makes me feel like I've got ants crawling inside my brain and I want to scream. I can stand it just so long, and then I blow.
It happened even at home. Everyone was talking at once at the dinner table.
One time, we had family over and the talk got me so crazy I hurled a plate at the china hutch. Glass blew everywhere. Ruined the meal. My parents asked me what got into me and I couldn't tell them.
That Connor is willing to share this with her makes her feel good. It makes her feel closer to him. Maybe now that he has opened up, he'll stay open long enough to hear what she has to tell him.
There's something I want to talk about.
Yeah?
Risa sits beside him, keeping her voice low.
I want you to watch the